The hits from the past few years of MPOG retreats has been what we call Best of MPOG. It's a mixture of research and QI, some QI implementation, and some research projects as well. Our first speaker is going to be Patrick McCormick, who's an assistant attending at the Memorial Sloan Kettering, and he's going to give you a chat about how they've implemented some Aspire work at their local facility. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Great.
And this is like 15 depth antennas.
Hi.
Let me figure out where to put my little, I'm going to put it right here. So, my name is Patrick McCormick. I am an anesthesiologist. I'm also the vice chair of informatics at Memorial Sloan Kettering's Department of Anesthesiology and Critical Care Medicine. I am also an assistant professor of clinical anesthesiology at Will Cornell Medical College, which is across the street, as I will show you shortly. What I'm going to talk about you for the next 10 or so minutes is a brief discussion of how my institution implemented Aspire and saw some pretty surprising to me results, which then we managed to actually get published in the cancer literature, making this probably the first ever publication MPOG in the cancer space. I have no disclosures to make. Nobody pays me any money for anything except for Sloan Kettering. So first, I just want to talk about what it's like to do anesthesia at a cancer center. I started working at Sloan Kettering back in 2016, and I confess, even though I had done all of my medical training and anesthesia training in New York City, I knew very little about this place. I knew that it existed, and they did cancer, and I assumed, I guess they must do surgery once in a while. Turns out, yes, they do surgery very often. Sloan Kettering was founded in 1884. It was the New York Cancer Hospital. And then back in the mid-1940s, after World War II, much of the original cancer therapies came out of classified defense research because many of the original antineoplastic agents were derived from mustard gas. So Sloan was involved in developing those into actual medical treatments. And then in 2017, we became the first cancer center to contribute data to MPOG. And then in about September of that year, we began the monthly emails to all of our staff. We have, Sloan Kettering has several sites. We do anesthesia at five of them, both in New York and New Jersey. That includes in Manhattan, we have the main hospital. We have an ambulatory surgery center about 10 blocks south. We also have regional sites in New Jersey and Long Island. There are about 60 attending anesthesiologists. There's about 120 CRNAs. We do not have a residency program of our own. We employ something like 4 or 5% of all the CRNAs in New York State. We tend to have, I like to say, they're actually very high quality nurse anesthetists because the job's very sought after because it's a nurse anesthetist job where they're guaranteed to be in there putting in double lumen tubes and doing laryngectomies and all sorts of high-level procedures when the residents aren't around. We do have residents that rotate in from Cornell and other places. We do all surgical specialties that you can think of except for obstetrics, trauma, cardiac, and transplant. When our patients do require the need of cardiac bypass or ECMO or cardiac surgery, we go and we send them across the street. So I didn't want to get run over, so I took this picture from Google Street View. But you can see here on the left is my place, Sloan Kettering, and then on the right is, with the little red flag, is New York Presbyterian Cornell. So we are literally catty-corner to each other, and that nice glass structure there is their David H. Koch Center, which opened last year, and then next year our David H. Koch Center is going to open on 74th Street. So everybody gets one. When in September 2017, we went, we had a big staff meeting, and we said, we're going to go ahead and start sending you guys quality, we're going to send you guys feedback about how you're doing your work. And the nurse anesthetists were rather concerned, and they wanted to know about how you're going to use these results. Is this going to be part of like my job approval process? Who gets to look at the individual results? And there were a lot of concerns like that. And we addressed them. We basically said that, you had the quality people and me and the chair would have access to look at the results, but that we basically told them we won't promise anything. We're not going to handcuff ourselves, but Our intent is not to use this in any sort of punitive or even in sort of a identifying the greatest person type of way. We're really looking at this in terms of more aggregate measures of where we can do better as a whole. Because we really, go on the theory that we don't feel that there's any one or two people that are actually causing problems. It's usually systemic issues across the entire institution that lead to us having quality compliance issues. We also said, we don't actually agree with all the measures that are in Aspire. So we went and we said, this low tidal volume, we're good with the less than 10 milliliters per kilogram IBW, but we think less than 8 is just a little too aggressive. And on colloid use, for some reason, Sloan and Kettering, they love albumin. You'd think that we were running out of it, but I mean, they use it all the time. So we said, we don't care about minimizing our colloid use. And then we also had the Aspire champions, which spent time one-on-one in with nurse anesthetists discussing about how to use it, what the email said, how to look at their cases, et cetera. So what I did, and was published this year in the Journal of Oncologic Practice, was we looked at the run-up to our implementation of Aspire, and then the run-up after that. And I have to say, because we also use AlertWatch, people know, we didn't actually get AlertWatch implemented until the next year. So this is, as far as I know, the only big change we made was going to getting Aspire. We ended up with this rather, surprising increases in compliance with a number of the quality measures. It's a little hard to see on the slide, but essentially, the one on the way bottom is the pulmonary 02, and the similar-looking purple one is pulmonary 01. So we, in addition to getting Aspire going, we said, look, guys, we want you guys to stop overventilating people, especially during, we had a big problem with thoracic cases. On one lung ventilation, people were just not paying attention to the ventilator settings, and they were overventilating our patients on one lung. And they're also overrunning patients in general. So we made a concerted effort to get that together. And we also said, hey, look, we want the blood pressures to be up a little bit. We feel there's really good evidence now that having low mean arterial pressures is going to lead to organ dysfunction at various levels. You guys got to stop doing that. And also, as we expected, the outcome measures that we track for troponins and kidney injury did not change significantly. And then this is the table showing in green. I've highlighted the ones that had significant p-values. And essentially, the big one one of the ones that actually turned out was a big issue was avoiding monitoring gaps. We looked and found that in our endoscopy suites especially, the time from the last blood pressure that was taken in the room to the first blood pressure that was taken in the PACU could be up like half an hour. And, look, we know it's just like, a colonoscopy, but still, it's, good practice is that we're actually checking the blood pressure once in a while after they leave the room. So we managed to go ahead and get that brought up. We also, one of the ones on the bottom, the core temperature measurement, was a problem because we actually didn't have the right temperature probes, I think. Our issue there involved LMAs because people like to put esophageal temperature probes in. But when you had the LMA placed, you can't really get it in there. And if you try to get it in there, the patient's going to cough and the LMA will end seat. So we had to educate them and stock some different ways of getting core temperature measurements to go ahead and meet that measure. So the lessons that I learned is that, first off, the reinforcement is pretty difficult. In our sort of core nurse anesthetists, we have, as you would with residents, pretty regular turnover. They come, they go to different jobs, et cetera, so we always have new people coming in every month, and we've made it as part of our regular every month training and onboarding of people. We're like, here's like what this quality measure thing is and how things are going to get into it and how you can go ahead and expect to perform on the emails when they come out. We also found that people tend to forget about it. They get the emails, they kind of delete them. They need some more periodic reminders of that, we are looking at the blood pressures, we are looking at the temperatures. You should try to keep that up. And I don't mean that in terms of an individual sense. We still maintain that I'm not looking at people individually. I don't feel it helps. We're still looking at it from sort of a departmental view. And so what we've tried to do is, I think at every 2 months at our QA, we'll go ahead and pick a certain departmental measure and say, this is the pattern we're seeing, how are you doing? Distance support helps. We have implemented additional distance support with AlertWatch and some other methods to go ahead and remind people when they are, you know, the tidal volumes are going too high, the blood pressures are too low, or the blood pressure is not being recorded. And I feel that has actually increased. In fact, I checked this week before I came, because this data now is a little on the old side, and we're still doing pretty good. We haven't seen the slump that I expected after the initial, you know, hurrah of getting, you know, fun, new, shiny quality toy. In fact, our blood pressure compliance is even better than it used to be. So that's been good. And another one, this is the last point I have here about the postoperative nausea vomiting problem. It's sort of unique to our cancer center. We started having problems with patients where we will, you know, we're very good about giving the dexamethasone as part of our postoperative nausea vomiting prophylaxis. And it turns out that if you have a patient you're treating with immunotherapy, giving them a medicine that makes your immune system not work for a while is not good. And it also turns out that if you want to do CAR T-cell therapy and you want them to have T-cells, giving the dexamethasone does not help with the T-cell count when they go ahead and extract them either. So we are having this sort of rolling conversation with oncologists over, you know, when, you know, should we just be identifying these patients? Should we not give dexamethasone at all? Should we go ahead and start buying, you know, lots of aprepitant or something like that, use an alternative medicine instead? It's an ongoing thing. And I will communicate this back to our quality, the Aspire Quality group, if it turns out that we feel we need a little tweak to the PONV compliance measure. And that's kind of my story. Let me know. You want to... Thank you. Sasha, are we doing questions now or at the end? No? Okay. Questions?
Hi. Amy Kurse, Cleveland Clinic. I do need to make a comment only because I'm a temperature freak. It's actually easy to solve that problem. If you put our normal esophageal stethoscope into the nose 10 centimeters, then you get a correct core temperature.
Okay, good.
There was a study a few years ago that compared putting it down all the way where you hear the second, where you hear the heart sound, and putting it 10 centimeters, and it's exactly the same.
You don't get any nasal bleeding or
anything
from that.
If you do it careful, no. But we stuff so many things into patients' noses, so no.
I'm okay with sticking things in people's noses, but some of my colleagues had this issue. Thank you very much. Yes. No, Cleveland Clinic is indeed the center for temperature stuff. I once saw at an ASA conference, I saw Dan Sessler toe-to-toe with the guy that built the bear hugger, who then decided he didn't like the bear hugger and decided he built the hot dog. You don't remember that whole story? Anyway.
Michael Andre, Penn State, Hershey.
Hi.
You seem to have introduced all measures and get feedback immediately, simultaneously.
Yes.
And there's obviously the choice to choose one and then follow a little later with the next one and then with the next one. Why did you choose the way you choose to introduce them, and could you discuss what the advantages and disadvantages were?
Okay, so it's a good question about, do you do the big bang approach or do you go gently? As I recall, because it was some time ago now, I think that on the email, I wasn't sure if I had the latitude on customizing the email to go ahead and have it be only like a handful of measures. Maybe it's different now. But at the time, I seem to remember that we could like knock off one or two, but then we sort of had to have the rest of them. So that was one driver for doing the big bang approach. The other thing was that we sort of chose to emphasize certain measures over others in the staff meetings. So we would tell people like, yeah, just ignore that one. Also, people would ignore some of them because they had ridiculously low denominators. And so that's the other thing we pointed out, was like some of these have low denominators. And the low denominator problem was really because of our practices at our institution. Like, for example, you notice I didn't say anything about the hypoglycemia. We didn't even include it in this study. Part of it is because we have very strange our diabetes policy is basically that we only take your sugar if, like, we, you know, somebody really, really, really thinks you need it. Like, there's no, we have type 2 diabetes, we don't do a finger stick. It's very strange. So we started trying to accelerate that in the department. It's more in the late 2018, 2019. But when we started doing this 2017, there weren't any glucoses, so the denominator was zero. And we said, just don't work on that one. Focus on the blood pressure, focus on the temperature, focus on the neuromuscular blockade. And then the idea is that as we will, now that we've rolled out a glucose program, we're going to go back and say, okay, now that we're actually taking blood sugars and you have data with which to do stuff, now you can focus on that one. Hi.
Ben Coy from University of Michigan. That was excellent. My question was, and sorry if I didn't catch it, were there financial incentives tied to any of the measures or anything that was put in to start implementing these, or was this... Yeah, I just wondering. I just know that a lot of these are, like, at least in other specialties, are often tied, right, to a financial incentive. I was wondering, were there any tied in this?
It's interesting, yeah. I came from a... My institution where I trained was a bit mercenary, where, like, we had one guy that he made all this money writing letters to the editor because it counted as a publication until they changed that rule. It was this very piecemeal way of, like, earning money, and my current place is not like that. So no, there are no incentives tied to achieving or reporting on a certain measure. My people do appreciate and use the MoCA Part 4 compliance, because that's something that, you know, this is pretty easy where you're able to attest to it. In fact, some of them got mad because, well, I confess, once or times I screwed up the upload and they didn't get the emails on time, so they missed a month. And they got upset at me. But other than that, no financial aspect. Hi.
Hey, Shreyas Bausar from MD Anderson in Houston, and we're an MPOG site that we're just trying to start submitting some data over. And you bring up a good point regarding patient populations and addressing issues such as giving dexamethasone for immunotherapy patients. Do you think that there's worthwhile in getting feedback on specific subgroups of patients? Because we're a cancer hospital, you're a cancer hospital, but we're getting compared to hospitals that are, they do all kinds of cases. And can you comment on how you guys are approaching that?
Yeah, I call it the subpopulation problem. It's not just for cancer patients. It happens, I think, for many different subpopulations in different hospitals, all represented here. The problem is that if you take your quality measure and you start divvying it up too small, then you end up with a quality measure that, say, only MD Anderson and Sloan Kettering even have a denominator for. And that's not very useful. I feel that these quality measures are most useful when you have a broad rule that can be applied to many different institutions, so you can try to find sort of what is the level other people can achieve or not achieve on this. If we had, say, more cancer centers or more children's hospitals or whatever into MPOG, I think that then it makes sense to go ahead and build up quality measures that are more population specific. And I think we are doing that with PEDS. Sachin's nodding. There's others that know more about that than I do. But it just doesn't work well if there's a quality measure that, like, only one institution really has any results for. So I think that's it for time. Thank you very much.